This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, December 16, 2005. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. On Capitol Hill, the U.S. Senate filibusters against the Patriot Act reauthorization bill. Workers and supporters from worker-run Bowen Hotel in Buenos Aires marched to the legislature. And continued coverage on trade issues emerging from the World Trade Organization negotiations. We'll bring you these stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. At the ongoing World Trade Organization talks in Hong Kong, a group of developing nations known as the G90 countries continue to resist pressure from the European Union to open up their service sectors. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
The service sector in the developing world is worth billions. The European Union is so eager to access it, Britain's European Commissioner Peter Mandelson allegedly threatened representatives of the world's 30 least developed countries with a further loss of trading access to Europe if they supported fellow developing countries in blocking the EU's call to liberalise their markets. But the G90 group of developing nations submitted a proposal anyway to the World Trade Organization, which waters down any plans to liberalize their service industries like banking and insurance. The non-government organization Christian Aid characterized Britain's tactics as dirty tricks and arm twisting. They say it casts doubt on the European Commission's commitment to fairer trade for developing countries. In addition to attempts to force other World Trade Organization members to talk about liberalizing services, the European Union also tried to ensure that the current level of service sector protection in developing countries cannot be increased. But for now, at least, the European Union has failed to secure its goals. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Argentine President Néstor Kirchner announced yesterday evening that his government will completely pay off its $10 billion debt to the International Monetary Fund before the end of the year. In a speech to announce the decision, Kirchner said that by using reserves from the central bank to pay off the debt ahead of schedule, Argentina will save nearly $1 billion in interest. A previous debt payment plan would have required Argentina to carry out a number of unpopular measures, like raising fees for public services, raising interest rates, and lowering exchange rates. Kirchner said that paying off the debt would allow future governments of Argentina the freedom to make sovereign decisions about the national economy. Earlier this week, the government of Brazil also announced plans to pay off the remaining part of its IMF debt in one $15 billion payment. In response to Kirchner's announcement, Brazil's Minister of Foreign Affairs told a press gathering in Hong Kong, quote, "I think it's excellent that our countries have been able, through their own policies, to reduce the dependency on international institutions." In other news from South America, Bolivians will head to the polls this weekend to vote in early presidential elections. FSRN's Dileta Varlese is in La Paz.
The timeline for this Sunday's presidential election is the result of an ongoing political crisis here in Bolivia. The last elected president, Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, was forced from office in October 2003, a massive popular protest. The vice president, Carlos Mesa, resigned earlier this year for the same reason. Special elections were then called so that Bolivians could elect a new president. The most popular candidate is the indigenous coca farmer leader Evo Morales of the MAS party. His rival, Jorge Tuto Quiroga of the Podemos party, is favored by the business class. Quiroga was the vice president to former dictator Hugo Banzer Suarez. Surveys indicate neither candidate will win the 50% majority needed to avoid a runoff. Final result will be made public on the 16th of January. For Free Speech Radio News, Dileta Varlese, La Paz, Bolivia.
As ballots from Palestinian local elections are counted, the ruling Fatah party appears to be losing ground. Manar Jabrin reports from Beit Sahur.
Initial results of local elections in the West Bank cities of Nablus, Jenin, and Al Bira near Ramallah show a victory for Hamas over the Fatah ruling party. Although the final results will be published on Sunday, early results indicate that Hamas has won 65% majority of the seats in the Nablus Municipal Council, a clear majority when compared to the 15% won by Fatah. This is the first time that Fatah has lost political control in the West Bank. Local elections were also held in 40 smaller towns in the West Bank. Results are not yet public. Palestinians will head to the polls again on January 25th to elect representatives to the Palestinian Legislative Council. Over 400 candidates have registered on 12 lists across the occupied territories for those upcoming elections. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
Workers from the country's largest public transit system have called for a selective strike. Rebecca Miles reports from New York City.
New York City's transit union, which represents 34,000 bus and subway workers, has announced what they are calling a partial strike of two private bus lines. The partial strike was called after last night's six-hour negotiation session with the Manhattan Transit Authority failed to produce a deal acceptable to the workers. The main issues separating the two sides are pensions, health insurance, and safety. Earlier in the week, New York State Supreme Court issued an injunction prohibiting the Transport Workers Union from striking, arguing it would cause irreparable harm. The injunction is allowed under the state's Taylor Law, which prohibits public employee strikes. The city administrators are concerned the union might consider a strike during the last full week of shopping before the holidays. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Senate upheld a filibuster against the Patriot Act reauthorization bill that seeks to extend many of the most controversial provisions in the act for another 4 years. The provisions, which include sneak and peek and roving wiretaps, expire in about 2 weeks at the end of the year. And as Mitch Jeserich reports from Washington, some lawmakers say their vote was swayed by a New York Times article this morning indicating that President Bush authorized the National Security Agency to eavesdrop on U.S. citizens.
The Senate GOP leadership failed to muster up the 60 votes needed to end debate on the Patriot Act reauthorization bill.
On this vote, the yeas are 52, the nays are 47. Three-fifths of the senators duly chosen and sworn not having voted in the affirmative. The motion is not agreed to. The point of order is sustained and the amendment falls.
Thus, the bill is stalled and will not likely proceed unless the measure is altered to include additional judicial oversight on the broadened authority of surveillance the act gave to law enforcement. Senate Leader Bill Frist is keeping the vote open, so another vote could still occur. The vote comes as an article in the New York Times said President Bush authorized the National Security Agency to tap into international phone calls and read emails of potentially thousands of U.S. citizens. Though what President Bush ordered did not involve the Patriot Act, many senators cited the article during the debate. Democratic Senator from Wisconsin Russ Feingold led the charge against the reauthorization bill.
I hope that this morning's revelation drives home to people that this body must be absolutely vigilant in our oversight of government power. And I don't want to hear again from the Attorney General or anyone on this floor that this government has shown it can be trusted to use the power we give it with restraint and care.
Democratic Senator from New York Chuck Schumer said he was undecided on the reauthorization measure until he read the article in today's New York Times.
But I went to bed, as I said, undecided. But today's revelation that the government listened in on thousands of phone conversations without getting a warrant is shocking and has greatly influenced my vote.
The Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, also expressed deep concern over the article, which the Times says has been held for over a year due to the request by the government based on national security concerns. The Times also said it withheld some information from today's article. Senator Specter.
It's inexcusable to have spying on people in the United States without court surveillance in violation of our law, beyond any question. And I can tell you that this will be a matter for oversight by the Judiciary Committee.
White House spokesperson Scott McClellan would not comment on the story.
This relates to intelligence activities and ongoing intelligence operations that are aimed at saving lives. And there's a reason why we don't get into discussing ongoing intelligence activities, because it could compromise our efforts to prevent attacks from happening.
Senator Specter also said he was disappointed on the vote of the Patriot Act, saying that opponents have mischaracterized it.
Other most prominent newspapers in the country published a story about 30,000 national security letters being issued, which is false. I cannot tell you what the facts are because it is classified.
Some of the Patriot Act provisions set to expire in 2 weeks include Section 215 that gives the FBI access to library, medical, and business records. The Reauthorization Act also seeks to extend the sneak and peek authority and roving wiretaps. Today's filibuster sets up a showdown between Congress and the White House. President Bush said in a written statement that he would not sign a 3-month extension of the current Patriot Act. But it appears that today's revelations of the U.S. government eavesdropping on phone calls and emails of U.S. citizens solidified the opposition to the measure as it is. Patrick Leahy is the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
According to the reports, it's being conducted under a secret presidential order based on secret legal opinions by the same Justice Department lawyers, the same ones who argued secretly that the president could order the use of torture. Mr. President, it is time to have some checks and balances in this country. We are a democracy. We are a democracy.
The Senate will operate into the weekend on this, the likely final week of this year's session. Mitch Cheserich, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
A series of explosions have detonated near the Interior Ministry in Baghdad's Green Zone today. And while voting in Iraq's parliamentary elections has now ended, a car curfew continues in Baghdad in an attempt to quash possible bombings. As many Iraqis try to return to a sense of normalcy and security, FSRN's Salam Talib spoke with Iraqi journalist Khalil al-Masawi in Baghdad.
Well, this election, all the indications shows a huge turnout in most of Iraq, and some of the reports says that is the largest, freest election in the Arab world. It was the quietest election with a few incidents, but there's nothing to mention, and it does not derail the process and the will of the people to go and dip their fingers in the ink, which we had to do in this election. The main interest, actually, the people went to the ballot boxes is in order to choose maybe a government for the national unity, a government which can deliver what is needed in Iraq, for example, the security and the economical reform in Iraq. And also we try to create a parliament which represent and reflect the Iraqi construction of the society, the whole people of Iraq. And what we have suffered from in the last period before this election, from terrorist activities and from, you know, derailing the political process in Iraq, the voting now, it is a big answer to the insurgent and to the terrorists in Iraq that we don't want you. Get out. And what those people who think they are resisting occupations by force, they have found out they are wrong by carrying the arms against the occupation. Really ending the situation in Iraq, it should be by political process.
Iraqi journalist Khalil al-Masawi in Baghdad speaking with FSRN's Salam Talib. Nominations have ended in Uganda for the presidential candidates who will stand against incumbent President Yoweri Museveni. Museveni had been serving his last term in office, but the constitution was amended to allow him to stand for another term in the 2006 presidential elections. Joshua Chilimpa reports from Kampala.
President Yoweri Museveni will tussle it out with 6 opponents, including the leader of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, Kano Kizza Besigye, who is in prison but was nominated in absentia. Besigye, widely seen as President Museveni's main rival, was arrested recently and charged with treason, terrorism, and rape of a woman on arrival from exile in South Africa, where he went after the 2001 presidential elections against Museveni. Besigye's message to the thousands of supporters was carried by his wife, Winnie Byanyima.
I bring you warmest greetings from Kano Kizza Besigye in Upper Prison Luzira. He is well. He is strong. And he is confident of victory. Kizza Besigye has said, we are all Ugandans and we don't want sectarianism here. Has been speaking for the people of Uganda, oppressed by Museveni.
Besigye has been compared by supporters to Kwame Nkrumah, a 1954 independence leader who walked from prison in the 1940s to lead the people of Ghana to independence. The arrest of Kizza Besigye and his continued detention by the military is of great concern to Mugenyi Sandra Robert, a Kampala trader.
For me as a Ugandan, I see for our President Museveni was not supposed to come again because his term has finished. To stand when the other candidate is in the jail, it means that he has become a dictator because he's not supposed to come at this time. To stand with somebody who is in jail, it is very bad. It's not good for me as a Ugandan.
South African President Thabo Mbeki, who was host to the jailed opposition leader, was in Uganda to attempt to secure the release of Besigye. He told journalists that his government was not aware that the opposition leader was planning to topple the democratically elected government of President Museveni from South Africa.
Certainly, if we had been aware of any activities involving any effort to overthrow a democratically elected government, we certainly would have acted against that, because that would be illegal even in South Africa. So if we had known any such thing, of course we would have acted. It may very well be that we didn't know, we didn't see, we didn't hear. But, I mean, surely, had the matter come to our attention and we had the necessary evidence, I'm sure the law would have taken its course in that regard.
Supporters took the streets of Kampala to celebrate the nomination of Kizza Besigye with calls for his immediate release. President Yoweri Museveni, however, says the issue of jailed opposition leader is beyond him, because the Uganda Constitution gives the Director of Public Prosecutions independence, and that the President can only intervene under the prerogative of mercy after the accused has been convicted. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Mass protests continue outside the WTO ministerial in Hong Kong as EU's trade chief warned that negotiations may once again come to a standstill. Economically developing nations continue to demand their share of open markets and for the U.S. and EU to stop subsidizing their farmers. Trade ministers are also becoming critical of trade for aid schemes. Arvin Bolel is a free trade minister for Mauritius.
As a member, we have a right. Our people has a right to live. Our people have the right to survive. We don't want to be marginalized. One should not use the perception of aid for trade simply to set aside long-standing preferences.
Nations represented by the Caribbean Community and Common Market, or CARICOM, are stating that handouts are not the solutions they're seeking at the World Trade Organization negotiations currently underway in Hong Kong. Ian Forrest takes a look at the situation facing CARICOM.
This is for poverty eradication. This is to help developing countries to be able to deal with health issues, education, etc. And therefore, we're saying if at the conference these issues are not in the forefront, then we cannot support.
Katie Knight, Jamaica's Minister of Foreign Affairs and Foreign Trade, on a trip to New York recently, speaking to FSRN about the premise on which the Caribbean would support the ongoing WTO negotiations in Hong Kong. And even now, before the end of those deliberations, his colleague, Guyana's Foreign Minister, Clement Rohi, is voicing concerns that market access for small and developing states is being curtailed. Guyana, much like other countries in the African, Caribbean, and Pacific group, depend heavily on preferential market access for their agricultural produce, largely sugar and bananas, an access which the European Union is phasing out. To Rohi, it seemed much of the stress these days from those in control of the trade agenda was an open and not fairer trade, and for even greater exploitation of the developing world, despite the expressed concern of eradicating world poverty, among other things, through the Millennium Development Goals. 2 years ago, on the occasion of CARICOM's 30th anniversary, Prime Minister P.J. Patterson of Jamaica drove home this point to an audience of Caribbean nationals at Brooklyn's Medgar Evers College.
Globalization is merciless. It acknowledges no historical indebtedness. It presently affords no protection to the weak. The preferential arrangements on which our countries have traditionally relied have been subject to the most vehement attacks in various multilateral trading fora.
He then compared globalization to Robin Hood working in reverse.
Robin Hood used to rob from the rich to give to the poor. The global market is robbing from the poor to give to the rich.
And with a diaspora that is the third largest immigrant group in New York City, the Prime Minister pointed out that colonial history had contributed to the propensity of Caribbean nationals to migrate in search of better conditions for survival. This, though, was proving a challenge to which regional governments had to rise, largely through training. Some would question the ethics of the situation when first world countries like the U.S. benefit, but don't always pay for the training of higher-level graduates that migrate there, and also of the capacity of the home countries to replace them. In Jamaica's case, according to trade spokesman Ambassador Peter King, that number is as high as 75%. Formidable though the task, the issue for him is one of engagement.
One challenge that we face is how we can harness that great, powerful weight of intellect and activity and energy in the broader diaspora to not necessarily return to the island, but to use their intellectual power and their investment and their influence to guide and strengthen what we do.
Looking on at the WTO proceedings, many wonder about the gains of the developed nations as they seek to negotiate away the very outlets for economic survival open to the developing world, desiring instead to replace fairer trade with handouts. For FSRN in New York, I am Ian Forrest.
The World Trade Organization welcomed the South Pacific Island nation of Tonga as its 150th member this week. Tonga has one of the world's smallest economies with a GDP of $244 million. In comparison, Iran has a GDP of $517 billion, but it needs the U.S. to remove sanctions against it before talks can even begin on Iran's ascension into the WTO. FSRN's Iranian affairs correspondent Saida Jamshidi reports.
Iran's request to join the World Trade Organization has been vetoed 21 times by the United States. The unilateral sanction against Iran by the United States began with the 1979 hostage crisis, during the term former President Jimmy Carter. Within days of the hostage crisis, the Carter administration seized all Iranian properties within U.S. jurisdiction and funds owned by Iran's central bank. The conflict between two countries escalated 25 years later, when President Clinton signed the Iran-Libya Sanction Act, known as ILSA. The purpose of the bill was to reduce Iran's ability to export oil and gas, to hamper its funding for development of weapons of mass destruction, and cripple its support of international terrorism. Although the fragile relationship between two countries has had its ups and downs, ties between Washington and Tehran has never been as confrontational as they are now.
They need to realize that powerful states such as the United States can basically veto, torpedo their, entry into the World Trade Organization anytime they want.
Professor Mehrzad Burujerdi is the director of the Middle Eastern Studies Program in Syracuse University in New York.
That's why, again, it becomes so much more crucial, in my view, for Iran to try to resolve its outstanding differences, with the outside world. Because, let's face it, we are not living in a Barney-like world where everyone is going to be friend and nice to each other. States pursue their own, national interest. And, if it's against them, they are going to have punitive measures against you.
Such as the ILSA, which is due for renewal in August of 2006. But that timeline is not early enough for Americans who fear losing investment opportunities in Iran. In one example, in July 1995, the American oil company Conoco lost a $760 million contract to a French company. Professor Frederick Lorenz is the lecturer of Jackson School International Studies at the University of Washington and a joint professor at the Seattle University School of Law.
This is a big debate today. Are the sanctions effective? Have they been effective? Who's paying the price? Do companies pay the price? Do the people of the country pay the price? These are all very good and debatable questions.
There is growing and urgent need on both sides. In Iran, a fast-growing, educated urban population is increasingly asking serious questions about their rights under the country's theocratic regime. In short, says Burujerdi, the Iranian government needs to be responsive to its people before they lose support both domestically and internationally. I'm Saida Jamshidi for Free Speech Radio News.
In Buenos Aires, workers from the Bauen Hotel and hundreds of their supporters marched to the city legislature yesterday to demand the city's mayor annul a law to return the hotel, which has been worker-controlled since 2003, to the former management. Meanwhile, rock groups are planning to perform at a mega concert tonight in defense of the Bauen Cooperative and other recuperated factories and workplaces throughout Argentina. FSRN's Marie Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
The employees from the Bauen Hotel, workers self-managed since 2003, rallied yesterday to pressure the Buenos Aires city government to veto a law in favor of putting the hotel back into the hands of the former owner. Last week, the city legislature passed a law to evict the workers and return the hotel to the former management that shut down the 20-story hotel in 2001. During last week's vote, police violently dispersed members of the Bauen Cooperative who were protesting against the proposed bill. Police shot tear gas and beat workers with night batons inside City Hall during the late-night Senate session. The workers argue that the former owner, Marcelo Ikovic, shut down the hotel fraudulently and never paid taxes or debts. The hotel was built with public funds in 1978 during the height of the military dictatorship. Gerardo Pensavage, worker participating in the cooperative's press commission, says that the cooperative is managing the hotel for the benefit of all workers.
Bauen is the very heart of the struggle for recuperated enterprises. We act in solidarity with all the workers' struggles. At the same time, they support us. If they mess with Bauen, they mess with all of us. Here's where all the social organizations meet. We go to support other struggles. We are not only defending 140 jobs, but also a different reality for a different Argentina.
Even rock stars are bringing the struggle of the Bauen Cooperative into the mainstream. Spanish rock veterans Residentes and Argentine punk icons Ataque 77 will be performing a stadium concert as a gesture of support for the worker-managed hotel tonight. Ataque 77 has even written a song called Setentistas, dedicated to the workers recuperating their workplaces. Ciro Pertusi from Ataque says that the employees at Bauen and worker-controlled ceramics factories Anon have become heroes.
In regards to Zanon specifically, it's a very humane act. Zanon and Bauen made me believe once again in humanity. Zanon has a motivation, which is love and the commitment to community. It's sure to spread and conquer.
During the rock festival, workers will speak about their struggle and show videos. The music groups will rock the night away so that fighting against injustices can be fun and filled with happiness. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.